Hello, I'm Scott Walker, and I've got some more musical milestones for you. On this edition, I'm offering up the stories behind some of the milestones that took place the week of June the 22nd, including the second number one hit by a British invasion group, a group of high school kids improvise their way onto the charts, a fashion model gives up the runway for the stage with a controversial song, the low point in Frank Sinatra's career, and a ranger almost misses out on a chance to create a big band classic. What it took to turn a 1967 flop into a 1969 hit. The record that convinced Bob Dylan to go electric. And the Beatles' first recording session is totally ignored, but 6 years later, they're playing to hundreds of millions of fans. So let's begin. The number one hit on June the 27th, 1964, was recorded by a British duo that had the distinction of being the first British invasion act to reach the top of the North American charts after the Beatles. But they couldn't have done it without a great deal of help from one Beatle. Peter Asher and Gordon Waller began singing together in school. Like many British musicians, they admired the Everly Brothers, and you could hear that in their sound. They were spotted by a talent scout and signed to the EMI label. Since neither one of them was a writer, they needed some material to record. Well, Peter Asher's sister, Jane, just happened to be going out with Paul McCartney. Paul was very much taken with Jane, and what better way to impress a girl than by helping her brother? Paul had written World Without Love, but the Beatles had decided it was not right for them. He'd then offered it to Billy J. Kramer, who decided it was not right for him either. Peter and Gordon decided it was just right for them. They followed World Without Love with several other hits before the duo split up in 1967. In the late 60s, San Francisco was a hotbed of the counterculture. The Haight-Ashbury district was hippie central. Meanwhile, a young woman was working in a job that was the antithesis of the hippie movement. She was modeling for a high-end couturier, walking around in their latest creations in front of a room filled with society ladies. The women would then order their own version of the dress that the model was wearing that would, in the model's own words, usually be about 9 sizes larger than the one she was walking around in. It was not a career. And when her husband suggested they form a band, she jumped at the chance to leave the dress world in favor of the music world. And a few years later, when the band had gone as far as it could, which wasn't very far, she was invited to replace the lead singer in another band, and she jumped again. In describing her gambles, she referenced one of her favorite books, and so it was only natural that she would write a song based on the same work. White Rabbit was written by Grace Slick, who had gone down the rabbit hole to get where she was. Her new band, the Jefferson Airplane, recorded White Rabbit, and it debuted on the charts in late June of 1967. It was criticized for its overt promotion of drug use. But Grace Slick always said it wasn't about taking drugs, that all the references came straight from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. If anything, she said, her song was a criticism of adults who told their children not to use drugs while downing several cocktails.
I'll drink to that.
Grace later said she should have made the message more obvious. Frank Sinatra began his solo career at Columbia Records, turning out hit after hit through the 1940s. But by 1950, Frank was almost becoming persona non grata, what with his public affair with movie star Ava Gardner while he was still married, and his public brawling and feuding with the media. All of this was hurting his popularity, and he hadn't had a big hit on the charts in ages. And then Mitch Miller arrived at Columbia Records as creative head. His concept of what would make a hit record and Frank's were quite different. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Mitch believed in ballads that leaned towards the syrupy or cute novelty tunes. Neither of those styles fit the Sinatra persona. But Frank's singing career was in the doldrums, and out of desperation or frustration, he finally agreed to record one of Miller's suggestions. In fact, it could be said that Frank Sinatra's career hit its lowest point on June the 23rd, 1951, when this tune debuted on the charts.
She said,
Mama will bark.
You look so lovely in the moonlight.
Yes, but Papa will bark.
Your eyes are shining like the starlight.
Yes, but Mama will bark.
Your lips are so inviting, darling. Give me one more kiss.
Mama will spank.
Please stop that.
Okay, you get the idea. Mama Will Bark, Team Frank, with a woman who went by the name of Dagmar. She was an invention of television, a celebrity whose talents were exclusively tied to her anatomy, a voluptuous vamp who was a staple of variety television. In her own way, she was the Kim Kardashian of the 50s. Mama Will Bark made it to number 21 on the charts. Not surprisingly, Frank left Columbia 3 months later. In the mid-1930s, there was a young big band fan named Van Alexander who wanted to be an arranger. His favorite band was the Chick Webb Ensemble, and he often caught the band's regular appearances at the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem. Eventually, Van got to meet Chick Webb, and one day he worked up the courage to tell Chick he had a couple of arrangements he thought would suit the band. Chick told him the band was rehearsing in a couple of days and he should bring the arrangements along. The problem was, Van didn't really have any arrangements at all, so he had to work fast. He arrived at the rehearsal with two brand new charts under his arm. The band tried them out, and Chick said he liked them, and he gave Van Alexander his dream. He hired him as one of the band's staff arrangers. A couple of years later, the band's vocalist suggested to Van that they collaborate on an idea she had. Van liked the idea, but things got in the way, and he forgot all about it. The vocalist got impatient and threatened to take the idea to the band's other arranger, Edgar Sampson. Well, that was too much for Van. He pulled an all-nighter to come up with the chart. The band recorded the tune, and it became a number one hit for more than 2 months, beginning June the 25th, 1938.
Yellow basket.
A Tisket a Tasket held the number one spot for more than 2 months, beginning June 25, 1938. Not only that, A Tisket a Tasket was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame, as was Van Alexander and the band's vocalist, whose name was Ella Fitzgerald. One day in the early 60s, a musician named Dino Valenti wrote a song about brotherhood. It was recorded by a group a few years later and released as a single in 1967. But even though it was the year of peace and love, nobody cared. The tune didn't even make the top 40. But a couple of years later, the National Conference of Christians and Jews began a campaign for Brotherhood Week. The conference distributed public service announcements to radio and TV stations and decided to include a copy of Dino Valenti's tune to emphasize the message. The constant airplay of the public service announcements for Brotherhood Week turned a flop into a hit, renewing interest in the Youngbloods' recording at about the time when flower children everywhere were embracing the same philosophy. Get Together debuted on the charts on June the 28th, 1969, and became a top five hit. In 1965, Bob Dylan recorded a tune for his album Bringing It All Back Home. He gave a tape of the recording to a friend who was managing a group that had gone by a number of names, including the Beefeaters, trying to sound British and capitalize on the British invasion. They also toyed with the name The Jet Set. The friend thought the tune had possibilities and had the group record it within days of Dylan's recording. But where Dylan's version had a country folk sound, the group gave it a rock feel. Dylan's original song contained four verses of rich, poetic imagery, and it took about 5 minutes to sing the whole song. The group decided to use only one of those verses to keep it short because they were going for a commercial release. And although it didn't do justice to the tune, commercially, it was a wise decision. The record was an instant sensation, reaching number one on June the 26th, 1965. By the time they went into the recording studio, the Jet Set were calling themselves The Byrds. Mr. Tambourine Man was their first hit, but ironically, they found themselves in the same predicament as the Monkees would a couple of years later. Their producer wasn't convinced they were good enough musicians to play the record, especially with limited studio time, so they brought in a group of L.A. studio musicians known as the Wrecking Crew to play the song. The only member of the band to actually play on it was Roger McGuinn, who provided his 12-string guitar. But the Byrds didn't take nearly as long to convince their producer they could play and sing. By the time they recorded an album to go with Mr. Tambourine Man, the Wrecking Crew had moved on to other projects and the Byrds were providing all the music. Their hit kicked off the folk rock movement and inspired not only Bob Dylan to record Like a Rolling Stone, but other acts as well to follow in their wake. Among them, a couple of unknown folkies named Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel. Before the Beach Boys and Jan and Dean came along, all surfing tunes were instrumentals, and the definitive example debuted on the charts in late June of 1963. The tune was actually an improvisation concocted out of necessity by a group of high school kids. They were just one of a million high school bands, but this band decided to make a record of a thing called Surfer Joe, which one of the guys had written. They got $100 together to book a studio and laid the tune down. The recording engineer told them they couldn't just put out one tune on a record. Records had an A-side and a B-side, and they needed something else for the B-side. So they invented something on the spot using the chords from Surfer Joe and adding a drum solo. Wipeout became another B-side that became a hit. The supposed A-side, Surfer Joe, was never heard again. The Surfaris were also never heard from again. Wipeout was their only tune to make the charts, but it peaked at number two. Another struggling young act had its first recording session on June the 22nd, 1961. It wasn't nearly as successful as the Surfaris, but the band was destined to be way more than one-hit wonders. The Beatles were playing at a club in Hamburg, Germany, alternating with another singer named Tony Sheridan. Polydor executive Bert Kampfert arrived at the club one night to catch Sheridan's act and signed him to the label. Sheridan asked if his friends the Beatles could be his backup band on the recording session, and Kampfert agreed. They accompanied Sheridan on his version of two traditional tunes, My Bonnie and When the Saints Go Marching In. Once Sheridan had finished recording his numbers, the Beatles asked Kampfert if they could record a couple of their numbers, too. Kampfert agreed, and Ain't She Sweet became the Beatles' first record. But nothing came of it. Fast forward 6 years. On June the 25th, 1967, the Beatles represented Britain in the first international live satellite television broadcast. It was called Our World, and it was watched by an estimated 350 million people. The Beatles were to be the main attraction, and they wanted a special song to perform on the show. John Lennon and Paul McCartney were always competing with each other musically, and each had a song they wanted the band to do. Paul had written Hello Goodbye, but it was ultimately saved for later. But John wrote a song that carried the message everyone was looking for. The Beatles wanted All You Need Is Love to be a big production number. A full orchestra was hired to play a cacophony of sound that featured snippets of everything from Greensleeves to Bach's Brandenburg Concerto to Glenn Miller's In the Mood. The classical musicians were quite nonplussed at the arrangement, to say nothing of the shenanigans going on in the studio with a choir that consisted of the Rolling Stones, Marianne Faithfull, Eric Clapton, and Graham Nash. A live broadcast can always be tricky, even in this day and age, and about 30 seconds before they were going to air, the producer of the broadcast called George Martin in the control room and said, "I've lost all touch with the studio. You'll have to relay my instructions." George thought, "Well, if we're going to make fools of ourselves, we might as well do it properly, in front of 350 million people." But the broadcast went off without a hitch, and All You Need Is Love went on to become the Beatles' 12th number one hit. And that's it for this week. Next time around, I will offer up stories such as the time the Beatles caused an international incident. Elvis faces an embarrassing television appearance, but gets his revenge the following day. And more musical milestones. I'm Scott Walker. Thank you for listening.